It's philosophy talk.
Why would you have something like that?
Collect them.
Can you want something for no good reason?
Isn't that a weird thing to collect?
I don't like stamps.
But what's the point?
There is no point. That's the point.
Roller coasters, horror movies, long distance running,
painfully spicy food.
Why do people enjoy such weird things?
I know it's weird, but I have a thing about it.
Is it irrational to want weird stuff?
You think this is weird?
Weird, but it's kind of cool.
You want weird?
It's weird, but it's impressive. You're weird, you know that?
That's my voice.
A perverse desire isn't just a desire that's in some way aberrant. It's one you do in part because you know it's wrong.
Our guest is Paul Bloom from the University of Toronto.
Weird wants. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Have you ever done something just because it's bad?
Is it irrational to do weird things?
Wouldn't life be boring if all your desires were sensible?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about weird wants.
You know, Ray, I'm totally fascinated by those weird wants. Like all those kids who ate laundry soap as part of a weird challenge. Or like when you deliberately loiter on the steps with the no loitering sign on them. These are strange things to want. What are people getting out of them?
Oh, come on, that's obvious. It's fun. Don't you just love jumping into the lake that says no swimming and walking on the lawn that says keep off the grass? It doesn't harm anyone, and it gives you a thrill to break the rules.
Okay, but eating laundry soap does harm someone. It harms you. I just can't understand why people sometimes go so dramatically against their own interests, and for no obvious gain. Seems like all they're doing is mindlessly following the herd.
I don't know. I don't think all those weird wants can be explained by peer pressure. Aren't you tempted to disobey those keep-off-the-grass signs even when nobody else is around? How can your peers be pressuring you when they're not even there?
Okay, so maybe it's something like a misguided sense of rebellion. Maybe people who do these things are trying to stick it to the man. They don't like authority, and they think they can somehow strike a blow against it by, like, trampling on a few blades of grass?
Nah, I don't really think that's the reason either.
Okay, smarty pants, what is the reason?
Well, why does there have to be a reason? Sometimes you just want to do weird things. No further explanation needed.
This seems like a case where we really do need an explanation. I mean, there you are, eating laundry soap, doing all kinds of untold damage to your internal organs. You must be seeing something good in it, otherwise why do it at all?
Oh, come on, Josh. You really think people always do what they believe is good? What about all those people who buy a membership at the gym and then never go?
Well, that's just weakness of will. That's a case where you know what you want to do, but you just can't bring yourself to do it. Eating laundry soap, that's a totally different category of action. I think those kids would be better off if they had less willpower.
Wait, so you're saying they have a reason to do it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a bad reason, but it's still a reason. Either they're showing off, or they're asserting their independence, or they're curious what strange things taste like.
Yeah, even if those explanations were true, eating soap wouldn't be any less mysterious. Why care more about all those things than you care about not poisoning yourself? It's just a weird thing to do, no matter what the reason is. Shouldn't we just abandon the search for an explanation?
I don't think we should give up before we've properly tried. I mean, think about it. There are lots of things people do that may look inexplicable from the outside, but once you take the time to empathize and learn, you come to see they make total sense.
Yeah, like what?
Well, this is going to be a little confessional, but for a long time, I was really confused why all my friends seemed to be claiming to enjoy foods that taste disgusting. Then it turned out I'm the weird one. Surprise, surprise. I've got a genetic variation that makes cilantro taste like soap. Once I learned that, everything made sense. I had a reason both for their preference, which seemed kind of weird to me, and also for my aversion.
Sure, that works for cilantro. It's okay to like it, it's okay not to. but sometimes people choose things that they just know are bad. Think of those kids who pull the wings off insects.
Yeah, but those are kids. Aren't we supposed to grow out of that kind of thing when we get older?
Maybe we're supposed to, but a lot of us don't. Think about the midlife crisis. You've got full-grown adults wasting money on a gas-guzzling convertible or blowing up their marriages. What's the reason for that, Mr. Rationality?
I got nothing, Ray, but I bet our guest will have something. It's Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, and author of The Strange Appeal of Perverse Actions.
But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to talk to some young people about their weird wants. TBH is a KALW podcast made by, for, and about teenagers. Holly asked the TBH team what they've done for no good reason. She files this report.
My name's Mahiran Dolia, and I'm going to be a freshman at UC Santa Barbara in the fall.
My name is Carolina Quadros, and I'm also going to be a freshman at UC Berkeley in the fall.
My name is Lauren Tran Machowski. I'm the production assistant for TBH. I'm going to be a junior at Wesleyan University.
My name is Miriam Reichberg, and I'm going to be a junior at Berkeley High School in the fall.
My name's Theodore Nguyen. I'm going to be a rising junior at Santa Clara High School. For no reason at all, I go onto Google Maps and just like type in a random location. Like one time I was in in class, I was trying to search up like a bunch of coordinates, and it took me to this random like island in the middle of nowhere, and all it was is just like some decrepit architecture in there.
What country?
I don't remember. It was like deep in like the ocean.
There are all of these quote-unquote secret staircases that lead through different neighborhoods of Berkeley that I'll like explore, and I'll go from like one staircase to another in different neighborhoods. And I also enjoy just like kind of walking onto UC Berkeley campus, you know, pretending I'm a college student, kind of seeing what's up. And I think it gives me like a sense of freedom, and it makes me feel free and like I'm exploring this new place. But again, I do it for no reason. I just, there's no like objective goal. I'm not going somewhere.
I like to like stalk the people that I'm going to be going to school with, but like hardcore. So I'll like, I will literally go to like their parents' LinkedIns. Like I will find their house on Zillow. Like I will like figure out what elementary school they went to.
It's find their Discord.
No, the other day I met someone who I had stalked on social media because it was the sister of one of my friends. And I was like, oh yeah, how's rowing going at college? And she's like, good. How'd you know that? And I was like, oh, I got caught.
In real life, I don't stalk people exactly. I just, like, I do that thing where you make up stories about them, except I literally give them, like, a whole new name. Like, I, like, and then, like, sometimes I, like, imagine, like, their, like, childhood house and stuff like that. Because, like, a lot of times, like, when I'm on public transportation, I'm really bored and there's, like, no signal. So then I just, like, kind of sneak glances at someone and then I'm like, oh, this is your name now and this is what you do and, like, this is why you're here.
I think because I learned how to type really young, I'm constantly, I'll like to the beat of a song or to the lyrics of a song, I'll type out a random word and try to like match the number of letters in a word to like the beats of a song or like a phrase in a song. Like for an example, KALW.org, that's a website I see in front of me. If I were listening to a song right now, I would try to match up KALW period ORG to the phrase or something of a song that I start with. And I always include spaces and capital letters as well, so I account for like having to press shift and the space bar and punctuation, even though there's no keyboard in front of me.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that weird and wonderful report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about weird wants.
We're joined now by Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at the University of Toronto and author of The Sweet Spot, The Pleasures of Suffering and the Search for Meaning, and, most recently, Psych, The Story of the Human Mind. Paul, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Paul, I've known you a long time, and you've always struck me as an eminently rational type. but you've started writing about people doing some inexplicable things. You're not going to tell us there's anything autobiographical in there, are you?
So one of the reasons I'm so interested in these weird wants or these perverse actions is because I don't have many myself. And when other people have them, they kind of freak me out and excite me and scare me and so on. I do have one, though. During my midlife a few years ago, I had to buy a new car. And against all rational guidance, I bought a Mini Cooper. I bought the car that Consumer Reports says, oh my God, don't buy that car. The controls are all in the wrong place. It breaks down every 4 days, and I'm 6'1", and I have to curl myself into a little ball in order to drive it. But I did it in part maybe because of those things, because this is a crazy thing to do, and by gum, I'm going to do the crazy thing.
So, Paul, you've got an essay on the strange appeal of perverse actions, and maybe the Mini Cooper counts as one example of such an action. Do you have another favorite example?
So the classic one I go to is from St. Augustine in the Confessions. So he begins book two by saying, I'm going to tell you all about these crazy debauchery sins I committed. And everybody expects he's going to talk about sex. But instead, he talks about when he and his friends walked into an orchard and stole some pears. And this fascinated him, because they had nothing against the owner of the orchard. They weren't hungry. They threw the pears to pigs. And Augustine understood his sexual desires, but he didn't know what to make of this. And finally he said, I wanted to do it just because it was bad. I love the evil in me. And to me, that's sort of a wonderful example of a perverse desire. A perverse desire isn't just a desire that's in some way crazy or aberrant. It's one you do in part because you know it's wrong.
You've found these kinds of perverse desires really puzzling or surprising. Why is that?
They seem to go against the view of humans as rational beings. You know, we depart from rationality in all sorts of ways. We suffer from weakness of will. We make mistakes. We do suffer from cognitive biases. But this is a whole different thing. It's where what we want, it's not a sort of weakness. What we deliberatively plan violates, goes against the good. Goes against the rational. And then you get into the debate that the two of you had over whether or not it's truly, they truly want the bad, or whether there's some other desire, some other itch that these perverse actions scratch.
Yeah, so in the case of Augustine, what kind of other desire might that be? Like, is he trying to impress his friends? Is he trying to stick it to God?
Yeah. So Augustine struggles with this, and he doesn't actually come to a conclusion. Much later in the book, he says, you know, I didn't do it because of my friends, to impress my friends, but I wouldn't have done it if I was alone. So I think one part of the story, I think there's, I'm a pluralist here. I think there's many different answers, many different motivations. But one of them is in some way is that it's a behavior that emerges in groups. Maybe whether you know it or not, to show off that you're the kind of person who really does want to stick it to the man, who really doesn't really need to abide by the rules. Maybe you want to show off your courage, your unconventionality, your creativity.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about weird wants with Paul Bloom from the University of Toronto.
Have you ever done something for no good reason? What did you see in it? Have you ever tried talking someone out of their curious choices?
The wacky, the wicked, and the weird. Along with your comments and questions when Philosophy Talk continues. Don't tell me what I want, what I really, really want. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about weird wants with Paul Bloom from the University of Toronto, author of The Sweet Spot.
Got questions about your weirdest wants? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and weird out in our library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Paul, we've been kind of arguing over whether you can act for no reason or for a reason that you yourself see as bad. Can you give me maybe the best case that everybody has to act for the case of something they think is good?
You may be right, Ray, that sometimes people act purely for the desire for the bad. Satan was supposed to be like this. Satan wants evil for the sake of wanting evil.
Right, evil be thou my good.
Yeah, very nice. When someone could quote Milton, you know, you're dealing with a true scholar. yeah, but I'm with Josh on this. And it's not an argument. I don't have an argument that it has to be this way. But I think as a matter of fact, when you look at people answering, they did it because they wanted to do something wrong. I think we could ask, okay, but why did they want to do something wrong? And I think we can get an answer. So it's an empirical question. It might turn out sometimes it's just badness for badness' sake. But I think there's usually an answer. So one answer I'm interested in, there's a few, is that we often want to be autonomous. We don't want to be constrained by other people. We don't want to be constrained by rationality. We don't want to be constrained by morality. And so like a hero from Dostoevsky, we do something just because we want to be free.
That makes sense. I mean, this is a very difficult philosophical puzzle, right? Because it seems intuitively to make sense that you would say to yourself, gee, that's the wrong thing to do, or that's a foolish thing to do, or that would be unpleasant to eat that laundry soap. That's why I'm going to do it. And, you know, Augustine talks about it. Aristotle talks about it. All kinds of people talk about it. But it also seems intuitive to say what you said, which is, well, you must have some reason for doing it. So how do you square that circle? I mean, Joseph Raz has a nice line about this where he says you act for reasons that you know don't justify the actions. So you have a reason, but it doesn't fully justify. Is that a good way of kind of getting right in the middle there?
Well, I think it would put a name to some of the reasons. So one thing I'd put it is autonomy. So Josh, suppose you know me really well, and you say, you know, Paul, let me tell you what your next book should be that you should you should read on this trip. And you actually know me better than I know myself. There are real world cases in this. But I say, I want to choose for myself. And then you respond and say, are you saying I don't know better? And I say, maybe you do know better. And that's a factor I should take into consideration in favor of following your advice. But here's another factor.
Or I tell you not to buy that Mini Cooper.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So I think one reason why I probably bought the Mini Cooper was that people close to me said, don't buy the Mini Cooper. That's insane. buy a RAV4. You know, buy a Toyota product of some sort or another. And in part, I think it made me want to buy the Mini Cooper all the more. And social psychologists have studied this. There's a field called reactance theory, which is what its name says. It basically is a series of findings that tell people, hey, you're drinking too much, and they respond by drinking more.
Okay, so I want to take a step back and question whether that's really doing something that you think is a bad idea, though. Because it sounds like it's doing something that you think other people think is a bad idea. But isn't the response then, well, just I don't think other people are reliable, and the fact that they think it's a good idea actually makes it suspect. Like, if somebody I really hate recommends something, I shouldn't do it, but that's because I want to do what's good, and I think they're a bad guide to what's good.
Yeah, there's sort of, I think one set of cases, what you're talking about, where I want to do what I want to do because I am the best judge of the best thing to do. And I think that's sort of a simple case and often happens. I'm more interested in kind of more complicated case where I might think that Josh could choose the better book. You could choose the better meal for me. And it really would be make me happier, make me more interested, make me more engaged. It's the better choice. But, and that has some weight. But being able to choose for myself also has some weight. So I want to choose for myself, not because I believe it will lead to an objectively better outcome, but because I just want to choose for myself. And I think this shows up in the midlife crisis. It shows up in adolescence. It shows up in a two-year-old insisting, let me do it myself, even though the two-year-old, if you said, you would admit that an adult would be more competent in this domain. You say, yeah, let me do it myself, man.
That part is also a little bit puzzling to me because here's a choice I made for myself yesterday. I went to bed at a reasonable hour sober. And I fully choose to do that. I just thought it was a good idea. Couldn't I choose the good thing for myself instead of the bad thing? Like, why does it have to be the wrong thing?
Oh, no, absolutely. I feel that the vast majority of choices by a psychologically healthy and socially normal person are, in fact, rational and moral. Most of the time, you know, when somebody says thank you, you say you're welcome. Most of the time, you walk past the orchard, you don't take the pears. And I think that's great. I think that that's how we should live our lives. But sometimes these constraints chafe against us. And then we rebel. So, sure. But have you ever gone to bed at an unreasonable hour, not sober, at least in part because you're supposed to be in bed by 10, having just drunk some warm milk?
I mean, can't say I've never done that.
Yeah, no comment from me.
I did something online where I asked people about perverse choices they made. And if you ask, pretty soon everybody comes up with at least one.
Ooh, yeah. I want to hear some of your favorite answers from this.
Oh, gosh. So I did this online, and one very polite person said that they play in a symphony orchestra, and sometimes they succumb to temptation to play a wrong note, just a single wrong note. One guy, my favorite one, was some sort of, and he was definitely a bro in some way, and he's with his other bro, and it's the middle of summer, he gets some ice cream, and suddenly he jams his finger into his friend's ice cream, and he just said... I don't know what he just said. It would really be messed up, I thought, if I just jammed my finger into somebody's ice cream. Although the exact term was not messed up, and I think that he was just astonished, and he said, you know, I hope, Professor, you could explain this, and yeah.
Do you think you could explain it?
Oh. As good as well as we could explain something else. I would say maybe he's expressing his autonomy. Maybe in a way he didn't understand himself. He was showing off. There's something, particularly if you're of a certain age, there's something appealing for being a risk taker, for showing that you are not the sort of person to always obey the rules. You are autonomous. So autonomy is valuable, but often showing yourself as autonomous could be valuable too.
Right. So you can be expressing your autonomy like Dostoevsky's Underground Man, right, who says, you know, one may choose what is contrary to one's own interests and sometimes one positively ought. In order to express one's autonomy, you can be showing off to your friends. You could be sort of indicating that you're not to be messed with, because who knows what that guy will do next. But what about, you know, something you refer to as hopeful monsters? I mean, so there's sort of trying stuff out, right? I mean, the things that are maybe taboo or risky, they seem like they cross some line. I think, for example, about surrealism, you know, there's a Man Ray image of baby Jesus being spanked, which is a pretty, you know, controversial image. But artists are supposed to push the boundaries of taste a little bit. We think it's perfectly okay for our rock stars to overdo it on alcohol from time to time, even though that might not be the best thing for their health, and we might not want our friends to do that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think about that? Is that, you know, is that one of the reasons that people do things that might be, I don't know, questionable interpersonally and certainly questionable from a health standpoint?
I absolutely think so, though I admit it gets complicated. So you think of cases like Marcel Duchamp submitting a urinal to an art competition, or Banksy having a painting that when the gavel comes down at auction, it automatically shreds itself. And at one point, somebody say, these are crazy, irrational behaviors. On the other hand, and here's where it gets a bit complicated, these actions made both of these artists famous, in the case of Banksy, more famous, and made them a lot of money. And so when somebody does something bizarre and unpredictable and irrational, in some way I'd like to say that could be very perverse. But if they're doing it with an eye towards, this is really going to get me a lot of clicks, or this is going to get me $1 million, or this is going to get me a lot of love and friendship, then it's just a clever way of doing a rational thing, an unexpected way of doing a rational thing, and in some way becomes a bit less interesting from my standpoint.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about weird wants with Paul Bloom from the University of Toronto. And Paul, I have a question about another way in which it might be kind of useful in a large sense to do irrational things, which is if you only do rational things, then you only know what happens if you do rational things. So this gets studied by game theorists a lot. So there are sort of game theoretic equilibria where everybody's behaving rational in response to everybody else's behavior. But like overall, people are doing badly, because nobody is ever being generous to anybody else. Do you think that that's a motivation for some of these weird wants as well?
I think yes. I think a lot of the weird wants show themselves up when you're dealing with other people, sometimes cooperatively, in which case sometimes a perverse act of generosity could get you out of a cycle of distrust and cruelty and really elevate things. Sometimes when you're competing with somebody, in which case perversity can be unpredictable, can be powerful. Sometimes, and this is sort of advice to graduate students in a admittedly perverse way, which is if you're competing with a lot of very smart people, and there's and it's in some way it's winner take all. Not everyone's going to walk home for a prize. The perverse act could be the smart one. And the example I'm thinking about is that I do play this word game Wordle, where you get to choose a word and how well it matches with the word they've chosen helps you win. And there's some really rational words to choose. And my wife chooses stare every morning, S-T-A-R-E, which is a great word. And I choose whatever word occurs to me at the time. And I always lose, except one day I chose puppy. And the word was
guppy. It's a terrible word for Wordle.
Yes. So I chose puppy, and it is terrible. But the word was guppy, and I got it in two. Well, my
crazy
wife
like a fox. I mean, well, crazy exactly. Like a fox, so I, puppy?
So,
I don't know.
So I said, I'm a genius. And she said, no, you just got lucky. You're perverse. But the thing here, the moral here is, suppose it was a world Wordle competition, and what you want to do is win. You can't tie. You got to win. The best strategy then is to do something hopelessly erratic, because everyone else has occupied the space of the rational. And to some extent, it's life advice, which if you're competing with 100 smart philosophers for a single slot, they're all very, very smart. So being smart may not be your best move. You may want to sort of go sideways and see if you could explore a niche that has not been explored. I don't know. Start a podcast.
But the worry for me here is if it starts looking like the reasons for doing these crazy things are too good, then they stop being crazy things and the puzzle goes away, right? So Socrates famously thought, we only ever desire things that are good. And if we do bad things, that's just by mistake. And some other philosophers have thought similar things. But it seems like that can't quite be right, because if the weakness of will examples we were talking about before. I mean, I don't dare let myself around gummy bears, because as soon as I've eaten one, I've eaten the whole packet.
Yeah.
And I know as I'm eating them, I don't want to eat these things. I want to stop, but I cannot stop. So that's clearly a case where I'm doing something that I know is not what I want, is what I don't want. So maybe these weird wants are kind of, they're not the same as weakness of will, but they're like the active obverse of that. They're deliberate, not just sort of passively getting swept along by my addiction to gummy bears. But a case where you choose something, yes, you choose it, but that doesn't mean that you think it's good. It doesn't even mean you think it's all things considered good. You have to recognize still that it's bad. It's either bad for you or bad for somebody else. You might regret it later.
Yeah.
Your very feeling of freedom depends upon you saying this is a crazy choice. A Mini Cooper is terrible for a 6'1" human being. So I feel like there has to be a way like that where we, on the one hand, we preserve what you're saying, which is that we can explain what's going on. But on the other hand, we preserve the fact that it's kind of weird and people are acting against either the moral or the conventional or even their own physical interests.
I agree there's a tension here. And I think you're putting your finger on it very nicely. And here's another way of expressing my view, which is if a perverse act is an act that you do because it's bad, because it's immoral, because it's irrational, period, then my view is there maybe no such thing as perverse acts. There are seemingly perverse acts or sometimes self-destructive, high-risk, silly acts. But in the end, if I'm right, and this is what I'm sort of exploring, in the end, there'll always be a story where someone's motivations are. It's either an attempt to deceive someone else that's gone awry, a way to impress other people that may or may not work, or an expression of autonomy that in the end you may end up regretting. But I think in a strong sense of perversity, perverse acts might not exist. There may be no such thing as Satan may be impossible.
So we've got a comment from Daniel on our website. Daniel writes, "There's something very attractive about the view that one cannot do evil voluntarily, and that knowledge of what is moral is a sufficient condition for choosing it. For if Plato was right about this," I think he means Socrates, "morality classes taught by ethicists and moral philosophers should be universally available and paid for by the state. So, Paul, what do you think? Can people ever do evil voluntarily, or is it always just ignorance?"
I think I like the spirit of the comment, but there's plainly cases where we do commit evil acts voluntarily. I've done a few myself. For the banal reason that I have self-interest. So sometimes there's something I really want, you know, and in order to get it, I have to do something bad. I'm not talking about a horrific act, but I'm not as simple as I don't want to do something, but I don't see a way out of it, so I lie. I say, I'm busy that day. I'm really sorry. I'm busy that day. I'm sorry. I'm too busy to blurb your book, even though I may have read the book and decided that I could not actually put my name on a blurb to the book. And I think these are bad. I think lying is bad. But I do it. I do the bad thing because we are, in other work, I would argue very much we're moral creatures, but that's not all we are. We also have appetites. And sometimes we self-consciously recognize my appetite overrides my morality. Does this make sense to you?
Yeah. I mean, like one way that I might read what's going on there is that lying is bad in one way. It's not a kind thing to do. It's not respectful of others, but it's good in a different way, which is that it gets you out of having to blurb that book that you don't want to blurb. So you're not doing it because it's bad, and you're not doing it even knowing that it's bad in all ways. You're just like, the way that it's good is so shiny. Like that is kind of the
fair
explanation
enough, right.
But then
we want to dig into cases where you're doing something bad because it's bad, right? Yeah. Either because it's morally wrong or because it's bad for you. And, you know, Milton's Satan is supposed to be that. And Anscombe, the philosopher Anscombe, says, nah, he doesn't really want evil. He just wants freedom. To which David Velleman, another philosopher, retorts, that would be a sappy Satan. And I kind of agree with Velleman, right? It ends up being like Dante's Satan, who's just doing God's bidding. I mean, what's the point of that Satan? He's basically just a flunky. So
I would
isn't
think if you look closely enough at Satan, you'll find he's sappy. And the idea is it's a very cool Satan, and as you know, the cool psychopath who wants evil for its own sake. But I think that may be an illusion. I think that may be something which just doesn't exist.
Well, I guess we'll hear more about sappy Satan after a break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about weird wants with Paul Bloom from the University of Toronto, author of Psych, The Story of the Human Mind.
How would you go about making your choices more rational? Do normal people make the world go round, or are they just boring? Should we all try to be more weird?
Letting our freak flags fly. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. Does having weird wants mean you're only happy when it's complicated? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Paul Bloom from the University of Toronto, and we're thinking about weird wants.
So, Paul, we've got a comment from Linda in San Francisco. Linda says, I've been collecting cigarette lighters since I was a teenager, even though I've never actually smoked. I now have hundreds of lighters, which my friends think is kind of weird. So am I weird? If I only had 20 lighters, would that still be weird? What about 5? Or is it just weird to buy any lighters that I'll never use?
Oh, there's a weird threshold. It often comes up with cats. You know, at what point is you have too many cats? I think in some way it's atypical to collect that many lighters. But weird could be good. And there's a satisfaction to collection. I like the story because it speaks to a kind of a broader issue, which is at least some psychologists and some philosophers have too narrow a notion of what people want and what makes us happy. And if it isn't making us money or getting us sex or status, people say, what is it? It's crazy. But I think there's a pleasure to collecting, a pleasure to possession.
That makes sense. But is there a limit to the kind of thing that we've been talking about? So, you know, your bro friend or bro student stuck his finger in his... Yeah. But he's ice cream once, and that's sort of funny or something. But if he did it every single time a friend got food, that might cross a threshold into something else. So are there limits? Like, is there a certain degree of, I don't know what, flexibility around norms that's psychologically healthy that allows us to be creative, like Duchamp, and to express ourselves and to feel autonomous? But then there's a kind of limit somewhere.
Some people think you can't judge how other people value things and prioritize one value over another. But I'm not one of those people. I agree with you. I think sometimes, you know, this could really be foolish and erratic, a perverse act that causes serious harm to people. People, for instance, may refuse to get vaccinated or refuse to take health precautions just out of a perverse impulse. You can't tell me what to do. And I think that's doing the math wrong. Dostoevsky's hero says, I insist that 2 + 2 = 5 because I'm going to rebel against it. And I think that, well, come on, that's just immature. That's, you know, so I think perversity works best in the right doses.
I might ask for guidance about when it's okay to be perverse, but I worry that that's a little self-defeating. So if I try to have a norm about when to break my norms, that's not going to help me, is it? If I'm trying to like govern my norm breaking behavior.
I've never suggested we should be meta perverse. So maybe you should be perverse, but meta rational, and you should dole out your perversity in a proper expected way.
Excellent.
Does that include sort of a percentage of your time spent being perverse? Because I can think of some people who are sort of, you know, indulge in these weird wants a great deal of the time.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, people like Augustine, who once in every so often will wander into a pear orchard and steal a pear. So is that part of it too? It's not just sort of the degree of the insanity, right? That you're actually eating laundry soap or something, also how much of your life it takes up.
That's right. I think you are not going to prosper in this world unless you are almost all of the time rational. If you use English the way it's supposed to be used, if you put on your pants to go to for a job interview, if you do all sorts of things. And, you know, and I have two sons I love very much, and I would never say, you guys need to be more perverse. There are plenty of perverse. There's I just want to also introduce one notion, though, which a friend of mine, Talia Wheatley, introduced to me, which is that of micro-perversity. And she suggests that often when you're talking to friends or just doing everyday things, something sort of a goofiness. Like, you know, you're sitting across from me and just kind of snatch a French fry from their plate. And no one's gonna, you know, St. Augustine's not gonna say, wow, that's impressive. But it's kind of a little bit weird and unexpected, and I think makes people more interesting and more fun, less predictable. And we want that just in the right dosage. I don't want somebody who's gonna, you know, grab my main course and stuff it in his mouth while I'm doing it. That's insane. But a French fry is kind of cool and charming.
Should everybody have the same level of perversity? So one thing that's kind of appealing to me is to have interactions where one person is kind of the straight man and another is kind of the clown. I have friends where I'm the straight man and friends where I'm the clown. Is it better to have like a distribution of attitudes toward perversity rather than a single attitude that everybody has?
I never thought about that, but I think that's a great idea. I think that that's true. I think that there's natural pairings either between different types of people or at least different occasions where if you're going to be goofy and perverse, best if we're hanging out together for me to be the straight man. If we're both perverse trying to play off each other, it's neither one of us gets any pleasure. There's pleasure to doing perversity and pleasure to witnessing perversity, but you don't want to do both simultaneously.
This is one of the things that I actually like really dislike about the recent hosts of the Great British Bake Off, is that they're both kind of goofy and it doesn't work because they've got no foil. And before, one of them was goofy and one of them was doing something else, and that was much better.
You need a foil.
Yeah.
Like I'll write a book on perversity, and then my next book will be about the foil. Which is this underexplored in philosophy and psychology. The straight.
I thought you were going to let us tell you what book to write next.
To read next.
Anything but the book on the foil, Paul. Anything but that.
Oh, when is the
use reverse psychology on that psychologist?
I got a title to Foiled, the strange psychology of the anti-perverse.
Nice, reverse psychology. That never works. Yeah. But I want to get back to when it's a good idea and when it's less of a good idea to indulge ourselves in these weird wants, in these deliberately doing something that we know is wrong or against the rules or against our own best interests. Because it seems to me there are two categories here. One is kind of self-directed and one is other-directed. So if I lick a battery, the only person harmed, if there is somebody, is me. Whereas if I walk on somebody else's grass, at least there's minimal harm to them. And certainly if I, you know, I don't know, if I'm a pathological liar and I just lie for fun to my friends all the time, or, you know, I could do something even worse. I steal their food or worse things. Wouldn't there be cases where you'd want to draw the line and say, no, that's just a thing you should really never do when it's other directed and it seems like really you're getting some kind of odd pleasure out of harming other people, out of making other people suffer?
Yeah.
Isn't that just at a certain point over the line?
Absolutely. I think that there's a set of priorities and principles we want to align with, and there's a complicated balance. So some acts of perversity, which I talk about, are genuinely cruel and horrible, and people should be, you know, imprisoned for them. Some people score high on a need for chaos scale, which is, you know, they wish for, you know, they want the world to burn, as the Joker was said to want. And I think that's way out of whack morally. But let me qualify that a little bit. Sometimes perverse acts in an artistic sort you talked about before do make other people uncomfortable. And I would say maybe a little bit of that is still okay, even though you might well cause discomfort. This is different from hurting people, different from cruelty, but some level of discomfort might still make the world a more interesting place and lead to long-term benefits.
Right, that Man Ray image of
exactly.
baby Jesus is obviously controversial. Some people won't like it. Some people will be offended. But, you know, that's art, and ruffling a few feathers is okay. But I'm thinking about, you know, psychopaths, and it seems like, right, you know, on some definitions of evil, evil is precisely doing something wrong that you know to be wrong.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's something that you think a lot about, but is evil a thing? Some people deny that evil is a thing. Does evil exist? And would evil look similar to the kinds of things you're talking about or different?
It's a really interesting question. I think I'm one of the people who think that evil isn't a thing. People do terrible things to one another, but they do them for reasons. And they do them because there's something they want. They want money or sex or power. It's because they have weakness of will. It's because they think it's moral. So a lot of my other work has found what a lot of people have argued for, which is that a lot of the terrible things in the world are done by people who believe they're doing the right thing. And sometimes in the case of perverse action, it looks like badness for badness' sake, evil for evil's sake. But I'm still tempted to think, and maybe in the end I'm wrong and Ray is right, but I'm still tempted to think that in the end there'll be some other explanation. It won't reduce to pure evil.
I want to ask about the value of a certain kind of perverse action and its link to protest. So it seems like a lot of norms persist after they've outlived their usefulness. So I'm thinking about this kind of guerrilla art project where some artists swapped the voice boxes of Barbies and G.I. Joes that both talked, or like maybe some other kind of like feminine doll and G.I. Joes. And that probably annoyed the parents of the children who bought them. I don't know if it annoyed the children, but it seems like there's a value to that because there's a value to kind of testing and breaking norms that might or might not be socially useful. Is that perversity, and is that a way in which perversity is good?
I think so. I think that's a case of hopeful monsters in a way, which is that doing something which violates the norms and violates the rules, even if the odds are that this is going to be nothing but trouble, the odds are they're like the notion in evolutionary biology are macro mutations that almost certainly die, but sometimes spawn a new lineage. And I bet for every Duchamp and Banksy, there's 100 artists we've never heard of because nobody got it and nobody liked it. But yeah, I would view that sort of protest and that sort of unconventional violation of social rules as a really interesting form of perversity.
So, Paul, what would you leave our listeners with? Should they embrace their weird wants? Should they try to minimize them? What advice do you have for folks?
Well, two things. I think one thing is we should recognize perversity in others. I think, for instance, if you want to know why people voted for Donald Trump or Brexit or people react to vaccines or whatever, it's really important knowing that sometimes people don't want to do what they're supposed to do. And this is a very human desire. And then the second thing is we talk in the right doses, at the right times, at the right proportion of your life, perverse acts could make your own life more fun, more interesting, more creative.
Well, I feel like perversely continuing talking to you, even though this show is over, but we can't do that. We're rational beings. So instead, I'm just going to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. This has been tons of fun.
Our guest has been Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at the University of Toronto and author of The Sweet Spot, The Pleasures of Suffering and the Search for Meaning, as well as, most recently, Psych, The Story of the Human Mind. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
Well, I'm thinking about a thing I've done this weekend, which is to get a book by an author who's kind of moralistic, who I disapprove of, out of a little library, and then make blackout poetry out of it, which I think is my little homage to the perverse.
That sounds fantastic. I can't wait to look at that. We're going to put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and dive into our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now, a man whose speed is not even the weirdest thing about him, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the first person to eat an oyster, it's been wondered, what went into that decision? The same with eating snails, I suppose, although melted butter and garlic had a lot to do with the genesis of that desire. There are many tastes which I would think are localized. Peanut butter, for example, which looks pretty nasty, really. Sashimi, durian. My dad hated tuna, so whenever he was not going to be home for dinner, my mother would make tuna casserole, which I loved. There are things I thought I would hate, but when I finally ate them, I didn't, like Brussels sprouts. There are unpleasant things that children rather enjoy, like pulling off Band-Aids, picking scabs, wobbling a loose tooth with the tongue. I also took a perverse enjoyment in procrastination. Having to shovel the walk, for example, would take me a half hour before I even went outside. First, I would whine and moan without specificity, and roll around the floor where my overshoes were, banging them together and sighing piteously until my father said, "For Pete's sake," which meant, "Get on with it." To which I would comply for a moment, until I tugged my overshoes on while lying my back on the floor, rolling around half-heartedly and singing Johnny Horton's The Battle of New Orleans under my breath as I clacked my heels together in rhythm, kind of trying to make the buckles sound like spurs, and not succeeding. I looked up briefly to see if my parents were annoyed. They probably were, but they were watching Gary Moore, I believe, whom they both liked for some reason, so it was hard to tell. The point is, as my mother would point out to me on many occasions in the future, if I spent as much time doing what I was supposed to be doing, instead of wasting my time avoiding what I would eventually have to do anyway, I could have had the job done and behind me, with the whole evening free to read a book or watch Gary Moore, whom my parents both liked for some reason. The point was, the lollygagging might prove to be my downfall, even though she never used that word, but I loved the lollygagging. I loved that it made my mother worry a little bit. My father was never worried, just irritated, which I suppose I took some pleasure in. For the most part, I was an obsequious little sprat, fearful of reprisals, so I took pleasure in disguised procrastination, you might say, avoiding the doing of things, not because I dreaded the doing so much, as being a snotty little anarchist, a me whom nobody was the boss of, but of course, they all were. Humans take their pleasure in the oddest ways, and of course I'm no exception, but I also don't take pleasure in things others do, like professional sports, which just make me nervous. Used to love wrestling, though, I guess because you always knew who was going to win. And the older I get, the more I wonder about other things that supposedly bring us pleasure. Driving, for instance. It costs a lot of money to have a car. Driving is work. It's supposed to be fun, but you have to pay attention or you could die. Internal combustion is a major component in the destruction of the planet. There are things that people apparently believe that just baffle me. Trans people are somehow oppressing us? How is that? I hear it all the time that poor people are responsible for their poverty. Well, it's true that I'm my own worst enemy, but that's because people who might hate me don't know me yet. And what about sex? Sure, sex feels good, but it often leads to heartache, which leads to sex. Vicious, vicious circle. Birth itself is painful, but we don't know what pain is yet, so it's kind of a wash. So the truth is, we're no strangers to pain, but our idea of pain, by and large, is more of an owie in the great scheme of things. If it's a fallen world, as some Christians believe, it's no wonder we embrace suffering. And that sharp pain you feel in your lungs when you take a deep breath outside and it's hovering around zero, if you do that over and over again real fast, maybe you'll get dizzy and fall down. And you won't have to shovel the walk. You're pretty sure Mom will notice you before you freeze to death in the steps. It's a risk worth taking. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich.
Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Huang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Come into my weird house. Hi, I'm Weird Barbie. I am in the splits. I have a funky haircut and I smell like basement.
Oh my God, I had a weird Barbie.
Yeah, you did.
You make them weird by playing too hard.
It's cool.